We really have what I believe is a 5-year window to really capture the brilliance of this generation and integrate them into the workforce. There's over 83 million millennials here, and if we don't capture their brilliance, integrate them, and get them excited about the work that we're doing, industries are going to fail left and right.
Welcome to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work. I'm Ken Kennard of Accent Interactive, and my co-host is Mike Boys of Credo Consulting. In this episode, we speak with Gabrielle Boucher, the president and founder of The Millennial Solution, a millennial-run training and consulting company bridging the generation gap.
I am so glad and so excited to be doing this with you. We met a few months ago, and I was so impressed with what I heard from you. I just thought, ha, we have to do work with Gabrielle. So we are just super glad to talk with you today about millennials in the workplace. It's an exciting topic.
And how appropriate that we have some representative from each of the three generations currently in the workforce, right?
Yep, that's kind of true, because Gabrielle is a millennial.
Very much so.
Yeah. And I'm clearly in Generation X. We'll need to define that.
And technically, I'm a boomer. I was born in 1964. So many people would say that is the last year of the baby boomers. And as I really dug into this topic a few years back, I looked at it and I was kind of sad to put down that moniker of boomer and pick up the moniker of Generation X.
You don't seem like a boomer in some ways.
Yeah, I kind of have one foot straddled in each world, I think. But when I really look at it, I was a latchkey kid. I'm independent. I'm resourceful. I didn't really look to authority figures to do anything for me. I did it all on my own. In fact, I started to thrive as a person when I got away from other older people and kind of had my own. So I'm very much an Xer in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And you seem like an Xer to me. I mean, I definitely relate with a lot of those same characteristics. I feel like I'm more likely to be an entrepreneur than some of the previous generations. And sort of a lot of my peers kind of struck out on our own.
Yeah.
And we didn't really look to our elders so much for mentoring. It was pretty unusual.
Yeah.
We didn't feel like we needed a lot of help. We just kind of wanted to figure it out on our own and make our own way. And, you know,
who needs them?
Right.
So, Gabrielle, besides the year you were born, what makes you a millennial?
Well, I'm having to laugh right now listening to the two of you, because everything you're saying is completely opposite of what a millennial would be saying. You would never catch a millennial saying, yeah, I'd like to figure it out on my own. No, we crave mentorship. We would never say, yeah, you know, I'm pretty independent. We're like, no, we crave collaboration. So very different. It's amazing just how a couple of decades can really redefine what it actually means to launch out on your own.
Yeah.
Well, what about a boomer? Like, why do you say you're not a boomer, Mike? What would make you a boomer if you
were?
Well,
I think, you know, boomers, they have very defined kind of role, like defined roles, and they like to conform, and they had to place a high value on paying your dues. And so part of it is, you know, my definition of, you know, having a right to do something is you do it, you know, your competence defines that. And part of that's kind of the, you know, being an intuitive thinker in the Myers-Briggs typology, but it's also just, you know, thinking, I'm going to do this on my own. And boomers think you do it as a team and everyone does their part, you know? So I think that's one of the main differences for me.
Yeah. And one of the things I see is that boomers tended to really support, in a lot of ways, the organizations or structures or systems, right? There was large nonprofits and governments and big companies.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't see that same value in my generation. Like our generation really values small companies more, small groups are more independent minded, more likely to start up our own kind of thing, less reliant on systems and processes.
Yeah. And Gabrielle, so it seems to me that there's a bit of I don't want to say independence to millennials, but kind of a independent collaboration kind of thing where you do things on your own, but you're always collaborating with other people. Would you say that's an accurate depiction or no?
Yeah, independent collaboration. I like that. Although it does sound a bit like an oxymoron, because we're all working individually on something, but when we crave the input and the ideas of others. So if you have a staff of millennials and you walk over and you give, you know, millennial number one this task to get done by the end of the day, it's just a matter of time until they have turned to millennials 2, 3, and 4 and asked for their help on the project. And right. If they don't have millennials in their physical environment, then they'll turn to the virtual world and start making their own reality and even making their own community online. We see that with chat rooms. We see that with social media. So although there's an individual millennial who wants to be recognized for who they are as an independent individual, we also believe that we're stronger together. I mean, the old adage used to be, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And I think that that's a mentality that millennials have really embraced.
Yeah. And so a couple of things strike me with that. And one is that it's not always just millennials they're going to reach out to. That they might just reach out to the Xer or boomer nearby. And that's not always met with the same happy greeting that the millennial might give them.
Oh, absolutely.
It just strikes me that if that happens, Mike, you've got a boomer that's responding to a millennial. Maybe that's going to require an adjustment on their part. Or how are they going to work that out? The boomer might be expecting the millennial to respond as an Xer because that's what they're used to training.
Right. Yeah. So what do you see with that, Gabrielle?
So a millennial who's looking for help, I mean, they may go out and ask a peer, but you're right, they may ask a parent, they may ask a professor, they may ask someone in their circle of influence. But what's interesting is that when a millennial makes that ask, they don't differentiate between generations. They may text a boomer just like they're going to text one of their good friends, or they may tweet at them, or they may, you know, find another form of social media to get a hold of that individual. Now, if that individual is of a generation or even of a preference of not being comfortable with that kind of social media, then they're either going to, number one, get offended because it's not a communication form that they're used to, or number two, it's not going to be effective because they just aren't comfortable and they're just not used to how this young person is reaching out. Yeah. And so it's simple things like, and I hear it all the time from my clients, why do millennials text me back after I call? Right.
I just dealt with that actually. I one of my millennials in my office, one of the people I work with, I found myself calling and getting a text back, and I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. Maybe he's like super busy, or maybe it's just not a great time to talk. And then it happened again, and then it happened again, and then I started feeling kind of offended. Like, wait a minute. Like, I have chosen the phone call for this particular issue, for this particular time, because I think it requires that. I need the back and forth. You know, it's not that I want to be on the phone. It's that it's a better fit for this kind of conversation that we need to have. And I noticed I kept getting these texts back, and I started getting frustrated. Like, this is feeling to me disrespectful. I'm fine with texting. I like that too, but it wasn't my chosen medium for that particular kind of conversation that I wanted to have at the time.
Yeah, for millennials, we use texting for so many different things, and it's our preferred form of communication. So when millennials love multitasking, we're addicted to it. I mean, if you walk by the desk of a millennial, they have, you know, 3 and sometimes even 4 different windows open on their computer at once. I mean, we're doing everything
That's
at once.
Too many.
We're streaming online, we're downloading things, we're filling out emails, we're doing reports all on the same screen, because we have been raised in a time where technology allows us to do multiple things at once. I mean, the question is whether that multiple things at once is actually effective and efficient, which I would argue that it's not. However, that is the approach that we're taking. So let's relate that to text messaging. Texting is the ultimate way for millennials to multitask while communicating. I can be writing an email, take a quick second, respond to a text, keep going back to that email, or I can, you know, be standing in line somewhere and texting and be able to communicate in that way as well. And so I've had multiple millennials explain to me that when they text, it's just for them to be able to multitask while doing other things rather than having to stop, have a 10, 15, maybe 30 minute conversation on the phone and not be able to produce simultaneously.
Right. And you can have a conversation. Like email isn't real conducive to a conversation, right? But texting's more instant. You know, we used to, you know, instant messaging hasn't really made it because texting took over, you know, it seems.
They've kind of merged in some ways.
Yeah, exactly. But hey, before we go any further, I think just for our audience's sake, we should maybe define what the three generations we are. I know a lot of people say we have five generations in the workforce. I think that's a huge stretch. It happens maybe in a few places, but really it's boomers, it's millennials, and it's Xers, right? So let's talk about what years of birth we're looking at for these things, okay?
So the most senior, that you're right, they're not as involved. They may be on boards, they may be in more advisory positions,
right?
But they are still involved as the traditionalists, and those are born between 1925 and 1945. Now the baby boomer generation was born between 1946 and 1964. Baby boomers were the largest generation in American history until they had kids, and those kids are the millennial generation. Mm-hmm. Generation X was born between 1965 and 1980, and they're about the third the size of the millennial generation. And that's not only because their birth years are actually smaller, but they're just a smaller population. Parents weren't having as many kids when it came to Generation X. So we see a lot of kind of that friction where many in the X generation feel a lot of the same feelings that millennials have, like wanting more independence, wanting to be fulfilled at work more, and having more autonomy. And millennial generation is now demanding that, and we're getting it. And the reason is because there's more mm-hmm. of us than there are of Generation X. So that partnership is so powerful. And right. The third generation is the millennial generation, and those are born between 1981 and the year 2000. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of definitions out there. If you Google generations, everyone not only has an opinion, they also have their own definition. But the numbers that I just gave you come from the U.S. Census Bureau, which is pretty standard across the board when it comes to talking about these generations.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, is the kind of world that I'm in, right? So I was born in 64. And, it on December 31st, 1963 or 64, you know, the person is not really different necessarily than the person January 1st, 1965. You know, it's a gradual change. And as Ken was in our conversation earlier was talking about who your parents are and how old they are kind of adds into that. And the other thing is, you know, I've read some authors who were really, really into this, who are doing a lot of research. And I've even heard it argued that a better breaking point for Generation Xers would have been 1960. But either way, there's a feathering. It's not like a stark cutoff point, right? It's, you know, so I bear, you know, a lot of characteristics of an Xer because of the year and the environment I was born into.
So I'm wondering if there are some common views about the millennials. The millennials are the newest to come into the workforce. So now it's time for everyone above them to kind of form an opinion, right? Like, who are these? What is this generation? What are they like? Gabrielle, can you give us some like typical stereotypes or common viewpoints that older people have of the millennial generation? And then maybe we can talk about, like, are they justified?
This question is what drove me into starting my company and even writing my last book, Five Millennial Myths, the Handbook for Managing and Motivating Millennials. Because as someone who was usually the youngest person in the room, I found so many stereotypes, ideas, just kind of generalities around this generation that I knew weren't correct. So I'll talk a little bit about them, but I really go into depth into why those particular stereotypes exist in my book, Five Millennial Myths. But the most common stereotype about this generation is that we're entitled. So many look at this generation and say, you're so entitled. You think you deserve a corner office and a raise every 6 months and, you know, maybe a hug at the end of every day. And And the reality is that this generation has been raised in a really unique time in history. During the 80s and 90s, it was known as a self-esteem revolution in parenting. So there was this newfound wave of empowering your kids to be whoever they wanted to be and do whatever they wanted to do. And many of those parents had the funds to be able to create the environments to invest in that. And so now as a generation, we've graduated and we listen to our parents. We think we can do anything that we want and be anything that we want. And oftentimes those expectations are a mismatch to the modern workforce. So for example, when I graduated from college in 2009, we had ideas in our head of the kinds of jobs and the kinds of influence we were going to be thrust into because we had done what I call the millennial American dream, where you do everything that you need to, where you take the classes, you study for the SAT, you do the extracurricular activities and fill up your resume before you're even a junior in high school so you can get into the good college, graduate the good college, and get a good job. But in 2008, 2009, when I was graduating, those good jobs didn't exist. And I watched friend after friend graduate and then not get a good job, go back to doing what they did in college. They were serving at restaurants, or I call this generation the most educated baristas, because we went back to do whatever we could to actually get ahead. So understanding the context for why millennials do demand so much, it's because we were raised during a time where we had expectations set, and it hit right at the time where the recession hit the economy and employers had no capacity to actually deliver on that. And so when it comes to dealing with an entitled generation, the first thing you have to do is set expectations on the front end. Onboarding is so important when it comes to millennials to help them understand, what kind of culture am I walking into? How long does it take on average for someone to get a raise or for me to get more influence? Or does my title need to change? I mean, these are the types of questions millennials have in their heads but may never actually vocalize it. The second thing that you need to do is that you need to have constant conversations with your millennials. Feedback is so important for them because it's going to help them understand how they can contribute. Feedback, a lot of times I have clients say, you know, they need feedback constantly. I mean, I'm their boss, I'm not their mom. I don't need to tell them how great they are every day. And millennials don't need positive feedback all the time. They want constructive feedback just as much because this generation is addicted to self-improvement. So if you as an employer show that you want to help them get ahead and that you want to provide feedback that improves their performance and the value that they bring to the company, they're automatically going to be more committed to you, not only as their employer, but also as an individual as well.
There's all kinds of dynamics going on there, I think. And you know, one of them is that what generation they're walking into. So the millennials are coming into the workforce and they're faced with leadership that isn't either a boomer or a millennial. A Generation Xer. And I think that that the way that Generation X trained the boomers to lead is an issue here. I think Xers are really at the core of this in a way, because Xers came in and said, talk to the hand. I don't need no feedback. Stay away from me. Just point me in the general direction and I'll go figure it out. Right? And then so they trained boomers how to supervise based on that. So now we have these two generations that learned that being a professional and being working means autonomy. It means lack of feedback. Stay away from me. And it means operating on your own. And so like they get this generation coming in who knows that feedback is the path to success. I mean, just because the Xers and the boomers didn't get it doesn't mean they shouldn't have had it. Yeah. That's the path to learning, right? So it's kind of crazy. And now they're seeing this and saying, well, I didn't need it. You must be a baby. And the fact that you want to talk to me is, you know, you're at a place. You have to earn your keep. And so there's a sense in which really the Xers and boomers have it wrong in a way.
I think that's a great point.
I think if You know, Gabrielle, one good point you made is why they feel this way, right? You said that it's a parenting issue, right? The parents came in and said, let's all have good self-esteem and we're going to create this environment where you can just believe that you can achieve anything and be anything and just do these five steps.
Who, by the way, are the people in the workforce who are complaining about them.
Yes, exactly. Well, but these are my children, so they're different. But if that's the reason that they came out with these unrealistic expectations, something you said, Mike, made me think of why do I feel so independent? One of the experiences that really shaped me in high school was that I had this desire to learn about things that were coming out, specifically technology. And I learned computer software to do analysis and graphing in my calculus class. And I would take this software to my teacher and say, what do you think of this? Can you help me learn this? What do you, you know? And he was like, oh, I don't get technology. I don't know how this stuff works. And so I had two options. I could stop learning or I could learn to do it on my own because right. the generation that was training me was not training me in the tools that were relevant and current right. and upcoming. And so I became a computer consultant because I learned in the morning and trained someone else in the afternoon. Right. It was really that soon.
Right.
And so the lesson that I was given was if you want to learn technology, yeah. you're going to have to do it on your own. Don't come to anyone else because they just don't get it.
Right.
They would tell you, oh, I didn't grow up with that. I don't know how that works. Maybe right. you could tell me. So as a 15-year-old, I was running a business training 30, yeah. 40, 50-year-olds how to point and click and drag.
Right, right. So Gabrielle, so Ken is learning technology independently in his world. How do millennials learn and what are their tools?
So like you, Ken, we have been thrust into a world with emerging technology that is changing so quickly. And if we were to look to our elders to ask for help, they would have that same exact response of, I have no idea. Like, I'm still working on my internet router. Like, don't ask me, you know, how to code. Like, there's no way I know Python, right? But we're a generation that because we're so collaborative, that we've created an online community with shared information. So for example, if a millennial is looking to discover new ways to use technology, if they're looking to create an app, well, first of all, there's an app now to create an app. But if I had no idea how to create an app, I'd Google it, number one. Then I would find thousands of different blogs, different reviews, different step-by-step tutorials, podcasts, even YouTube videos to learn how to do that exact thing. Now there's also so many classes you can take online through organizations like General Assembly who will actually teach you how to code. So because of our demand to learn together, there's been a surge in new ways to actually teach these skills. And because things change so quickly, there's these online communities that are just chatterboxes for how things are moving. And millennials love it because it's us learning and moving together. I often say, if you want to punish a millennial, put them in a room by themselves and say they can't talk to anybody. Millennials
or text
crave
anybody.
Community. Right. Absolutely. I'm taking your phone away. That's the real punishment. but we're a generation that craves community. And particularly with social media. And one of the myths that I talk about in my book is that millennials are addicted to technology. And it's not necessarily a myth. I'll put that out there. I mean, 85% of us say the very first thing that we do when we wake up out of bed is grab our smartphone. I mean, so we can't imagine a life where we didn't have constant access to the internet and that we couldn't Google the answer to something. But because of that, we have expectations about how quickly information is delivered. And that also translates into the workforce, is if I can Google something, why can't you tell me the answer right now? I was once talking to a manager who shared with me that he was taking his young millennial out with him. He's in the sales industry, and this young guy had come to the office and hadn't shaved, and his hair was kind of ruffled and didn't own a jacket. And so this manager kind of took him under his wing and was like, let's get you a razor, let's fix your hair, borrow a jacket, and we're going to go. And so they went out to the sale, and they're sitting down with our client, and everything was going well, and the questions were being answered and asked. And then at the end of the meeting, the client had a question that the manager couldn't answer. Rather than just the manager saying, hey, I'll get back to you on that, the millennial to his right pulls out his smartphone and starts Googling the answer. He then, a couple seconds later, has an answer for the client. They continue on with the meeting and then they walk away. Afterwards, the manager explained to me how disappointed he was in the millennial next to him. He said, "Why in the world? Why would you do that?" Now, as the millennial, he was thinking, "Look how handy I am. I'm delivering information to you quickly, and I'm answering your question right now." But the manager wanted to have an excuse to follow up with that individual. He wanted to have a better answer, and he wanted to have an opportunity to talk further about closing the sale. Now, the millennial didn't understand that because millennials think quicker is better. So it was a learning moment for both of them to understand setting expectations and having conversations about what role does technology actually play. Because although it's an incredible tool for efficiency and for communication, it can also be a point of distraction for so many young people, particularly in the workforce.
Yeah. So Gabrielle, what that story, there's so much there to explore. And it harks me back to something I was thinking about in an earlier part of our conversation. And that is that millennials need strong leadership. So what I hear in this man is he's doing what many, many people aren't doing when they encounter millennials. I think that the Generation Xers and the boomers are so confused about what it means to lead because they have this idea in their heads because of the way they were shaped. Is that who am I to set the standard? They'll complain about the way somebody else behaves. But in their head, they also have this belief that it's all relative. And who am I to impose my stuff on people? So they'll complain about a millennial. They'll complain about each other. But they won't actually say, hey, let's talk about that. And let me tell you how things work in the real world. Or let me show you what's expected. They leave the things unsaid. And that is devastating to organizations. And when I see people and I talk to them about working with millennials, my challenge to them is be a leader. And there are things they're bringing into the workforce that are fantastic. And there are some things they're bringing into the workforce that ain't so good. So your job is to separate the wheat from the chaff, take the people under your wing and teach them. And you'll both be better for it. But a lot of folks just aren't doing that, like this manager seemed to be.
Yeah, it's a natural form.
I was just going to say, that seems to me to be really motivating to have a leader. You know, it'll bring you out. It'll make you want to go to the next job. It'll make you want to try again. And motivation is a key part. I mean, it's interesting, Gabrielle, that your book, the subtitle is The Handbook for Managing and Motivating Millennials. I mean, the first time I read that, I thought, what does it say about a generation that they need someone to professionally motivate them?
You're such an Xer.
I know. I just thought that would never happen 20 years ago. No one would ever make a living motivating my generation. It just does. I don't know. Maybe you could speak to that. Like, what are they? Are they unmotivated, and why? And how to motivate them?
It's a really great point. And again, we can go back to that context for how millennials were actually raised. And I think I often look at how a generation was educated to see how their expectations have been set. So for example, millennials have been taught to the test their entire lives. We know what it's like to fill in the bubble. At the beginning of every semester, we have a syllabus that we go through, and millennials will often ask, you know, what size font is this supposed to be in? Or, you know, what kind of font? I mean, they're so detail-oriented because they know what it's like to have their grade punished because they didn't go by very specific little teeny tiny rules. And so we've been conditioned to look to the teacher or the professor to set the expectations for us. This is what good looks like. Now, there's no syllabus for life, and there is no final test that we have to be taught to. And so walking out of a world that is very structured and very specific with little circles that you have to fill in to somewhere that's very abstract and very fluid, like the workforce, many millennials are finding it frustrating and even terrifying because they're just not used to that kind of environment. And unfortunately, our higher education system is not preparing them for that. Last year, there was a survey of professors, and they said, what one skill do you think that this graduating class, which are millennials, that they need desperately to be able to succeed? And what they said was time management. Time management, one of the most basic skills that any individual, no matter what industry you're going into, needs. On the other end, one of the top characteristics that managers are looking for when they're hiring is communication skills. Mm-hmm. So these are very basic skills that unfortunately we're not being taught in higher education. And so we're having to kind of learn by doing. And so managers who are hiring these young people are finding it frustrating that they don't have the basic goods to come in and actually integrate well into the workforce.
Right. And so, and I would look to the parents, right? So the millennials are a product of their parents. And, you know, when you look back, it's Generation Xers invented the term work-life balance, right? And millennials are living it out, right? So it was kind of like actually not really Xers, it's probably boomers that invented the term. And it's their kids. They talked about, you know, I value my relationships. Family's more important. And they learned this late in their lives and they taught it to their kids. But they didn't live it. They worked hard nights. They did what was expected of them and they didn't draw boundaries. And millennials are saying, you know what? Work-life balance is important. And this technology has enabled me to do it. And I can be, you know, at Starbucks. And I can do things and work and I can be with my friends at the same time. And so I'm going to draw lines and I'm going to live by them. And so we, you know, the things we're seeing millennials do in a lot of ways is what their boomer parents wanted to do. And frankly, there's some resentment that I see in organizations that I didn't have that opportunity. So why can't they suck it up? Right. And well, maybe because they've learned the lesson from you, and maybe, you know, the fact that you're complaining about it just really shows that in fact you needed it and you feel deprived of it. So why should we give it to other people? Which is kind of really an immature attitude.
And if that's your perspective, what would motivate you as a boomer or even an early Xer? Sounds like it's not going to be what would motivate the millennial. You don't tell the person, hey, this is your civic responsibility. Yeah. This is your duty. You know, play your role, fit into the larger organization. That just doesn't resonate, does it?
Well, you know, I don't think what's motivating people is different, because what motivates people, the strongest motivators of people are challenge, the opportunity to grow and learn, and autonomy. These are among the strongest motivators people have. But we feel dissatisfied and disgruntled when other needs aren't met. And when you're dissatisfied, it's difficult to be motivated.
Okay, so what dissatisfies you is not just the opposite of what motivates you. There's
exactly.
Different factors at work there.
It's a platform for motivation. And I think that the millennials are, you know, they're demanding the platform stuff, right? But what they're going to leave for is a lack of an opportunity to grow. No future here. I can't collaborate. I don't have a say. We've taught them, look, you're the most educated workforce ever. We've always asked you your opinions. You have this expectation that you're going to have input. And then they get to the workforce and they say, my voice doesn't count. Where's my future here? Why should I stay if there's no future here for me? Would you agree with that, Gabriel? That's what I'm seeing. But you really are more of an expert on this. So what's your perspective on that?
I think that you hit it straight on, because we're a generation that have, again, had expectations set for us by our parents. And there's this fantastic quote by a parenting expert from the 50s. His name is Chaim Greenough, and he said, "We often criticize the next generation as if we had nothing to do with creating them."
Right.
And it's so true. We look at them and we say, what's wrong with these kids? And I'll tell you, many of the managers that I work with, because I'll come in and I provide workshops and trainings for companies to understand who this next generation is. And I have managers come up to me afterwards and say, I don't know what's wrong with kids these days. I mean, they're so needy and they just expect me to do everything for them. While at the same time, they're getting a text from their son to come drop off their geometry homework. And I mean,
and they go and they deliver it, right?
And they drop everything and they do it. And so you have to take an introspective look here and say, how did we actually get to where we need to be? Now, the millennial generation is not lost. We cannot give up hope on them and say, oh, well, they're all just, you know, they're all brats and there's no way to get around it. We're in an incredible time. And this is why I get so passionate about the work that I do right now, is because we really have what I believe is a 5-year window to really capture the brilliance of this generation and integrate them into the workforce. There's over 83 million millennials here. And if we don't capture their brilliance, integrate them, and get them excited about the work that we're doing, industries are going to fail left and right. I recently conducted a study with an organization called Gen F Katie up in New York City, and we did a national survey of millennials, asking them about their ideas about entrepreneurship, what role education has played in their life, but also to what industry did they think that this generation was going to disrupt the most. Overwhelmingly, the top industry millennials believe that are going to be disrupted is government. They said government is not going to continue existing as it is if we have anything to do about it. If it's going to be taking our tax dollars, we're going to demand more efficiency. We're going to demand more technology. We're going to demand more access to our leaders rather than just being told from afar that this is what is actually happening. The second area that we are going to most disrupt is the banking institutions, which we're already seeing. Banks, traditional banks, brick and mortar banks on the corner, are going by the wayside as online banking is emerging. But that doesn't mean that millennials don't want to have information about personal finance. In fact, they're craving it. I was doing some focus groups up in Maryland for a community bank, and what we found was fascinating, that this generation craved information about how to become financially independent. I mean, again, this generation is $35,000 in college debt on average. So we're a generation who really, really needs help when it comes to managing our finance. But we weren't asking for help in person because we were embarrassed. We needed help, but we didn't know who to go to. Right?
You know, that sounds like when I first went jewelry shopping for my wife. I was terrified and I left the jeweler because I felt so inadequate. So, but go ahead.
That's why I leave every store, Mike. That's why you have to help me shop for my own clothing.
Sorry for interrupting, Gabrielle, but I just thought that was funny. So I'm sorry for interrupting you, but please continue.
So we're a generation that we're going back to the form of communication that we're both most comfortable with, right?
Yeah.
Which is Google. We're Googling this information, and the information that they're getting is either going to be helpful or hurtful. So for banking institutions, if you want to be relevant for this generation, you have to create online resources. You have to create chat rooms. You have to create YouTube videos to be able to communicate, because we're just not going to walk into our neighborhood bank and say, hey, can you help me get out of debt? That conversation isn't going to happen.
Oh my gosh. You've got me thinking about my children now, because I just had that conversation with my son and he lit up at the idea of financial independence, you know, growing for the future and things like that. But he never would have initiated that conversation. And so that's got me thinking, well, you know what? Google is great for a lot of things. Like, there's a lot of things that can be answered and there's a lot of learning that we can done. But here's the thing, that sometimes you need an actual person. Sometimes you need an actual relationship to deal with the subtlety, the nuance, the competing values that are there. And I think that information is necessary, but certainly not sufficient for life's big challenges.
The only time I walk into my bank is when I need to have something fixed that requires a personal appeal, or I have to influence them. So I want to be a person to them. I want to turn on the charm, you know.
It's hard to wink over the internet, right?
It is hard. It is hard.
Now, there's emoticons, though. It's okay.
Exactly.
The last time I went into my bank, I asked them, how does this part of your website work? And the woman on the other end said, I don't know. Let's figure it out together.
Oh, that's a good response.
It was a good response in some ways because she was willing to help me.
Right.
But then I left thinking, really? Like, you don't know how your own website works?
Right.
That's a problem, because your website is actually the way that all of the new customers that you're trying to attract are going to be interfacing with you. Mm-hmm. And that should be a top priority for you.
Yeah, I think, I would agree. I think you want them to know. right? And so I give them a little more grace because their interaction with people is the personal side. So I agree, but I also see it a little differently. I think that the response was, let's learn it together. I'm going to help you. I'm going to collaborate with you, and we're going to figure it out. But they should know. I agree. But
yeah, and the person helping me has no power to fix it. And the end of the conversation was, I guess the website doesn't do a very good job at that, does it? And I was like, well, whose responsibility is that?
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like it's both and.
Yeah. Yeah, they're probably evolving more towards that. You know, I think that there was something we were talking about, Gabrielle, that around the entitlement and around this issue of independence for being financially independent for millennials. And one of the things that I've been paying a lot of attention to is the idea that, you know, some people believe that millennials are irresponsible with their money. I've heard that said because they don't know how to spend it. And this is coming from boomers generally. I've also heard from a number of financial people that millennials are saving at unprecedented rates. They're saving in retirement savings at unprecedented rates. And the attribution is because they know that they are responsible for their future in terms of for their financial future. And they have in these educational debts, and they realize that, you know, by golly, someone's going to be caring for my parents, and it's probably going to be me. And so I had better be ready for all that's coming at me when the time comes.
Absolutely. So, I mean, these are conversations that I have with my family often. My sister and I will have this conversation often. And you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to take care of our family? Because my parents are both entrepreneurs. And so my mom, she just turned 70 today. Happy birthday, Mom.
Wow.
And yeah, so she was 42 when she had me. And so kind of to your point earlier, how your parents, the age of your parents also influences how they raised you as well. So I'll take these personality tests and these generation tests, and I always get baby boomer, and I just kind of have to laugh because my mom is the very first year of the baby boomers, and so because of that she gave me a very different perspective on life.
Yeah.
but both of my, I mean, she's on Social Security right now, but it's a conversation that we have of how are we going to take care of our family in the future. And when you're talking about financial independence, it's of course going to be a huge gradient of, you know, people who are informed about it and people who are just kind of ignoring the obvious. What we're finding though is that individuals on the coast, the East Coast and the West Coast, actually have lower levels of savings than those who do it in the Midwest. And part of that is just kind of the principles, I think, that many of those families may instill in the next generation. And there's much more kind of independence. They're usually, people on the coast tend to move to the coast or move away from their family versus those in the Midwest who may be closer to their family. But of course, it depends. You can't paint a broad stroke across 83 million people. Just some perspective. So the nation of Germany has about the same amount of people as the millennial generation does here in the United States. And so it's like saying every German doesn't know how to save, right? I mean, you can't paint something that broad across. But I think as a generation, we are learning that our own relationship to money as we're going along. And we had to have that mindset reset for us by the recession, where we were graduating. We were saying, I'm not going to make $60,000 after I graduate. I'm lucky to make $35,000 if I graduate in 2008, 2009. And as the economy is recovering, millennials are now have had their expectations reset and say, oh, wow, I actually should do something with this money. And I'll tell people this, and I talk about it in my next book, The Millennial Entrepreneur. The recession was one of the best things that could have happened to this generation because it reset our expectations. I think it humbled a lot of us, and I think it showed us how to be scrappy, because if we were a generation that was graduating into opulence, into six-figure salaries and corner offices, I think that would have taught us that, yeah, absolutely, you deserve it just because you are. You didn't really have to work for it. And so the recession really required an onboarding onto life that many millennials hadn't been prepared for. But now that we're on the recovery side of it, I think that it's showing the character of the individuals who've actually chosen to rise above rather than to become the victim of the situation that they've been in.
Yeah, that's so key. So, as we wrap it up, Gabrielle, I'm wondering if you could talk to us about the opportunity here. Like, what's ahead of us? What's really at stake? You talked about a 5-year window where 83 million of these millennium workforce members, like there's an opportunity here. Tell me more about the 5-year window and what do you see as possible here?
Yeah, we're really at the apex right now of the millennial generation. So I'm 27 years old right now, and I really represent the median age of the millennial generation. And so because of that, there's, you know, half of us are on one side of my age group and the other half are on the other. So I kind of feel like a little bit of a bridge. When you study generations, there's millennial group A and millennial group B. A is the first generation that's been born. That's usually the 27 to 35 year olds. And then millennial B are the, you know, 16 to 30, to 25 year olds. And we're starting to see different characteristics of who these next generation is. But as we are developing as an industry and developing as a workforce, we have 5 years to really reset how we're going to embrace new generations. Every generation has their own challenge with the upcoming generation. It's something called a micro rebellion between generations, where they reject the approach of the generation right before them and trying to embrace their own sense of identity. And if we lose this generation, if we as a workforce choose to not create HR policies that embrace the millennial interest for technology, so to speak. So, for example, using gamification for onboarding or using technology to provide feedback instantly. I mean, these are the types of advancement and evolution in how we're training the next generation that need to take place now. Because if we choose to not in the next 5 years, this is a generation that will leave your industry and your job and go and create their own. Now, as I've spent 2 years studying millennial entrepreneurs, and my book is coming out this spring called The Millennial Entrepreneur. And in this book, I've discovered that this generation craves innovation, but even more than that, we crave mentorship. And so it's an incredible opportunity to partner experience and wisdom with creativity and innovation that the youth bring in. And that is really where the power comes in. And so we really are at this apex of collaboration between generations. And that's where the power is going to come.
Right. So it sounds like the challenge, or that for people listening and for the generations ahead of millennials, is to really do two things. One is adjust your work practices, because this is the future, and we have to enable them and prepare them for the future. And the big part of that is learning to mentor, which people struggle with, because they weren't mentored. They didn't know how to mentor. And so figuring out how to mentor and get that done is a very important thing for the future of our world, really, because this is the generation that's taking over the future and the generation after them. And so we have to show them how to adapt, and we have to show them the way to go forward using their particular talents and skills and all that good stuff.
Yeah, listeners might want to go back and look at the mentoring episode that we did on that topic earlier in this podcast. Well, Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining us on this very important topic and for the insight that you bring. Really appreciate you being on the podcast with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been awesome.
Thanks for listening to WorkWise. Check out the show notes for links to Gabrielle's website, millennialsolution.com, her book, and also several articles about working with or as a millennial. Also, if you'd like to find out if you really behave more like a millennial or a Gen Xer or a boomer or something in between, click the link to the online survey and we'll let you know. You can also find the survey at creativitylabs.us. Just look for episode 6 on the podcast page.
Ken and Mike out. That would be very millennial. Hashtag bye.